Thank you. I don't know if you actually want to start by saying some words about Masota, as you didn't really give much of an introduction before, or if...
Say some words about Masota?
Yeah.
Well, Masota is, of course, the trigger of the project, but at the end, it was rather a sort of an alibi to talk about other things, things that I'm sure interested Masota as well. So it was never the intention to make a biopic, of course, but at the beginning it was much more concentrated on the happenings of Masota and what they meant, even more in a visual art context. And then with the addition of the fictional parts, then it really became more about, I think, artistic responsibility, maybe.
Yeah, I always, it's the third or fourth time I've seen the film, and I'm always so struck in the last part by how, we're thrown into reality in quite a brutal mode, but we're thrown into reality through fiction, which might seem like a contradiction, but it's not. I mean, it is through fiction that, like, you reach the most realist mode, and it happens in a very subtle or gradual way. Because when the ladies are putting on their white coats, we recognize some of the ladies from the first happening, and then we're like, oh, we're still in like happening mode. They're going to put on some coats, and something will happen, and then and it's very conversational, like La Eterna, like the rest of the film, and then slowly reality sinks in through fiction. So I don't know. Do you want to talk about that relationship between fiction and reality?
It's a big question, but Cortázar always insisted that the story of Second Time Around was both a fantastic, belonged both to fantastic literature and to realism. And that ambiguity is something that I find very interesting and that is very present in the film, which is very ambiguous all the time. And it's really placed at not really, you're never really sure of the status of what you're watching. And you as well, there are constant references to the audience who's watching the film, placing in the same place as the audience of the happening, of course. So you always wonder as a spectator what part of responsibility is yours, how do you have to react to that. So it really plays at blurring exactly who's the audience, who's performing, is this historical, is this not historical, so it's very much related to that. Then there is also something in the last part, and it is also I always found that it relates a lot to an old film of mine that is Zimmer Gespräche, which was about the Stasi. And I already, when I was reading about this, I always remember that when working with the Stasi, I was always shocked as how meanness and incompetence can mix, and that is really very typical of totalitarianism and also of stupid governments like you have the Trump administration. It is really fascinating how incompetent you can be and at the same time how much harm you can do. And then you wonder if they were less incompetent, if they would do more harm or less harm. And this is something very, very, I think, very typical. And, in Franquism, all sorts of dictatorships, it always makes ignorance, stupidity, and then really will to harm people. So this is something that is very present in both films. And so on the one hand, when you have this, when you enter the Segunda Vez episode, then of course you're always wondering, what are these people doing? I mean, when they're all the time asking, could you make out who was working and who was not working? Or at the beginning when they ask, is there people working over there? Because it's really, you can't understand really what's the purpose of this. And I think this sort of purposelessness And the complete absurdity of the questions, this is what terror produces. So terror is really, the point, I think, in dictatorships is that everybody's innocent and everybody's guilty. You have no idea what determines guilt or innocence. And so one second you think nothing will happen to me because I haven't done anything, and then you realize the next moment that actually that is totally irrelevant. And so that all that is a bit in the last part.
Yeah, when you were just mentioning that question about can you recognize who's working and who's not working and what work are they actually doing, and then there is this sense that, I mean, no one's really working, they're all performing, and they are performers as well, the people who are allegedly working. And so, I mean, I did like wonder throughout the film, but maybe more specifically in the last part, because it appears to be fiction and so it appears to be scripted, like how what was your relationship to the performers and how much are they interpreting the story from Cortázar, or how much to what point are they acting a script, or are, like what room of interpretation or of because it feels, and I mean, and that's where the terror comes in, because it feels like very natural and improvised. Like they're like having to come up, both the young boy and the young girl, they're having to come up with a conversation. But then when we move into the interrogation room, it almost feels like they're having to come up with questions. That they have not been given questions in advance, but I don't know if that's just how talented actors they were, or yeah.
Yes, so the actors, I think actors in general, but actors in Argentina, they are very good actors, and they are also very cultivated, and they are also very, mean is not really the right word, but they know, sharp, let's say, sharp. And how it starts, because I work with actors, I always work with everybody the same way, whether it's a performance or it's a film. So there is never a script really to learn, but it is always a sort of improvisation, because I don't really believe in a scripted dialogue. And so we work for 2 days prior to the shooting, and then everyone has a character. And then they knew what had to happen because they all had read the story. They also, it was very important, the structure, the architectural structure, so that you had this kind of corridor where you could see what was happening at the very end of it. You had these three atmospheres, the waiting room, the kind of clerk or office, and then the last room of the interrogation room. Everybody knowing what character they were, they had to improvise. And so we did a whole day of running over the different the whole scene, because the idea was to shoot in once, so there was not too big any cuts. Of course, a lot of characters that were not very important, they took a lot of importance depending on the kind of actor that was playing it. So, for instance, you have the crazy guy which is smoking. His only instruction was to sit behind the computer. But then he took a lot of liberties. And then I liked it, and so I let him do this. And if we had shot longer, I think he would be the main character in the movie. The only instruction was that the two young persons, they had to improvise a conversation, and based on this improvisation, the people on the back, they were going to do guides. They were going to try to repeat the same questions. That was the instruction. Everything else is improvised. So you just have different actions. I also have to say that in one of my trips to Buenos Aires to prepare the film, they robbed me and they took away my bag, and then I had nothing left, and I had to go to the police to do the report, or for my insurance. Although everybody told me you're wasting your time, they will never find anything. But then I went there, and actually this has a lot to do with my experience in the police, because everybody was wearing a white overall, and I could not understand why they were wearing a white overall. They paid absolutely no attention to me whatsoever, nothing, like if I was invisible. And they were all the time going out and in with shopping. They were all the time shopping, like going to the supermarket. And at the end, well, I almost had to scream that I wanted somebody to to just to write down what I wanted to say. And so it's really almost every character in the middle room comes from my experience with the police. Yeah. That's very realistic.
Well, I mean, you just said that you wanted to shoot everything in like one continuous shot, and I mean, there are not many shots. There are maybe four or five shots.
But there are three cameras which are filming at the same time.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah. And then I guess during this last segment, maybe it's when it becomes more apparent or more emphasized the fact that you use long takes. But then I was thinking, actually, you use quite long takes throughout the film. Yeah. And in the last segment, I mean, I guess the long take emphasizes that idea of being in, like, there's no escape, being enclosed, like, you know, that what's happened to Rocco. You know, but then, I guess, throughout the film, like, you use long takes, and is that to do with, like, truth? Or, you know, we were talking before about, and maybe that's another question, about, like, the high... with Helicóptero, which is a very minimal work or a very minimal piece, but it's like high production. And then you were joking, like, oh, if things had gone wrong, you would have had to edit the Helicóptero into the film. But in a way, you're not like using editing, you're using long takes as to, like, I don't know, is that a way of emphasizing truth or the...
I think that's an editage of how you call that, video performance. That's it.
No, and
I'm a big believer in long takes. Yeah, I really believe in long takes, and I believe in no cuts, and I really believe in truth. In the sense that I don't like scripted dialogues. I don't like makeup. I don't like artificial lighting. So I don't like any of these things. And for instance, in the last part, there is a lot of incongruences. Is that English? In the sense that, you have a poster of the Che Guevara, and you have also posters of the Beatles, and the library is really a lot of, left literature, which has to do, because actually this place is originally a place where of an association that to console or to bring help to victims of the dictatorship. So it is, of course, a left association, but it also has a lot to do with the reparation of the dictatorship. And I was also thinking, on the one hand, that was nice to think that actually it was a kind of a pop-up interrogation place that just has taken possession of an office. On the other hand, I thought that it was nice to add to this paradox, thinking that you will have a kind of, perhaps it's in the future, so that this is not necessarily happening in the past. Perhaps it's happening in the future. Perhaps it's around the corner. And this was, of course, months before Bolsonaro came to Brazil, but this is a bit terrifying, because this is probably, we are weeks, or maybe it's already happening in Brazil. So, so I thought, I didn't like to touch much of the original space, and then slowly I started to convince myself that actually was completely right, that all those things were there.
Yeah, because there are many. There are other. I don't know if interferences, but I mean of the present, like the Norwegian or Swedish woman is speaking in a mobile phone, and that's the moment when you're like, oh, and then you look at everyone's clothes and you're like, of course, it is the present day or the future, as you say. And then with the other restagings of the ghost message, it is in contemporary Buenos Aires. I don't know if you still have Channel 11.
No.
On so I mean, I did wonder, like, what would be the how did that confrontation between those pieces being restaged in contemporary Buenos Aires and confrontation with the local population or the local art scene, the contemporary art scene, who are the audience in the restaging?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was always the idea, and never pretend to make an epoch film. So that was completely out of the question from the beginning, which was also very lucky because we could not afford it. And it was, but also because it was never pretending to be the original one. It was always the idea to film the repetition. Mm-hmm. And in a way, this wanted to be extended also to the Cortázar film and to La Eterna. So we were not pretending to film the in any moment the original thing. And then it was, of course, a lot of discussion, especially with the first one, to induce the spirit of the image, because there were some people that had been in the first one who came to see it. And there were a lot of, first there were a lot of urban legends. I don't know, for instance, there were people who said that actually Masotra threw the fire extinguisher to the people. They remember it much more violent, but I knew that didn't happen because I just knew that Masotra could not possibly do that. It was not a type of that type of person who throws fire extinguishers to the audience. And there also some people thought that it was too harsh. And so, for instance, we had a young man that insisted on bringing seats to all the performers. So he was just coming and saying, would you like to, because he thought that they were really being cruel to these people, because he thought they were real poor people, and then they were actors. And then the actors, when I say this to the actors, they said, yeah, but we are poor too. We are actors, and then we are poor. But so he really wanted, and then for him it was too hard, and then for the original people it was too soft. So the lights were not strong enough, the sounds was not harsh enough, and so they also had trouble. They also thought it was a bit colonial because I was coming from Spain, and that was a bit, that hurt a lot, and so there was a long discussion about that. So yes, there was a lot of, and there was they said very bad things about me in the newspapers, but I didn't care because I only wanted to film. So it was, but they thought it was a bit, how you say, that there was still in a hero that no one had to, maybe two or three people cared about Masotra in the 50 years that had passed. Nobody else really cared, and all of a sudden I was still in the patrimony of Argentina.
Yeah, I guess that was the question, like what is the relationship between, I guess, what would have been his scene in the 60s, but in the in contemporary Buenos Aires, between the art scene and that legacy. Yeah. Like, but I mean, you're saying that they hadn't really thought about him for 50 years. No.
But not much has changed in Buenos Aires, in the sense that you very much have this, the Universidad Torquato de Itela is a place for rich people. They don't like that you say that, but that's the truth, in the sense that it's expensive to study there. And and so that means that the confrontation of class was still, I don't think it had changed a lot since the time of Masotra. And so what is very interesting of Masotra is that he was what they say in French, déclassé. I don't know how you say that in English. Déclassé. So he didn't belong
to
any class, in the sense that he has completely, abhorred, is that English? I always wonder. Abhorred from his original class, which was low, middle class. But he wanted to gain access to the bourgeoisie. He was never, because as you know, you never can really gain access to the bourgeoisie if you are not born in it. So he was all the time, this was something that was very much obsessive for him to find a place for himself. And I think that's that has not really changed much since in 50 years.
With I guess in that piece you have the poor people, but who you say they're actors, but I mean, like, the audience are not meant to know that they're actors, and the audience are the bourgeoisie, but the audience are also performers. I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, we are watching them. You know, and then I started thinking about that because there is always, in your work, and we're talking about that before, that blurring of the between the audience and the performer, and it's something that they talk about in the library, like the character, reader character, and you this afternoon you were talking about metafiction, and then I thought, well, I mean, and there is that blurring in Masotra's work too, because they. I think just by the act of watching, they're performing cruelty, and so in a way they're becoming performers too. But then I thought, we are watching them watching, and is anyone watching us? And then, like, how do you deal with that when you work, when you move on to film, where that relationship between the audience and the work is different? And I guess, how do you see that relationship when with working with cinema? Or how can you blur it? Or who was watching us? Well, you were watching us.
Well, everybody is watching everybody all the time. Well, it's just something that is. I work a lot with that. I like it because in performance, you always assume when you, as a visitor of an art place, you always assume that you are the one watching. And at the moment that the thing turns around, and then you become aware that actually they are watching you too, then the whole game changes. It becomes very interesting because then you don't know if you should escape in panic or if you should actually perform. When I was younger, this is something that. We worked a lot with in performance and in theater to imagine that all of a sudden the public had to perform. Like, you know, you would turn the light to the public and then you would not give any instructions, but then just because you didn't give an instruction, people wonder, what do we do now when the light is on us? And so this has to do, of course, with the idea of performing in public space, the idea of the performance of the everyday, which is a very much beloved concept of the 70s as well. And as well, it has to do with this idea of a very Lacanian idea of the desire, how the desire is always to be aware of the desire of the other. And so I just can't say that I enjoy this sort. I don't really have a solution for it or a conclusion. I just think it's very interesting the moment in which you invert the idea of the spectator into someone who's being watched. And of course, this could go ad infinitum, this notion. But in the case of Masota, he also introduces this idea of money. And that's what they comment in the library when they say, well, we also have been paid to be here, and we just don't leave because we have been paid, and then you have this kind of, you know, they paid me, I can't just go even if I want to because this is my job. So this is quite interesting how you change, how money changes things as well. And so that's also a big part of discussion.
But I think now it's time to invert and move on to your questions because I don't know how long we have, 10 minutes? Yes, Jean?
Thank you so much. I was in the press release, Masotto's relationship to Lacan and the fact that he introduced Lacan to Argentina and to Spain was raised. And then it comes up in the film as well. So I wonder what was at stake for Masotto in relation to Lacan. But also, can you say something about, because it also says that they're the most analyzed country in the world, more people are analyzed there, and what the relationship between Lacanian psychoanalysis and the dictatorship is. If you've got any thoughts about that. So there's a few questions there. You know, what's at stake for, what was at stake for him? Why? Why was it so important for him? And why? Because it obviously was important for you, because it's in the press release, it's at the beginning of the film.
So the reason why I became interested in Masota is because he was practicing a sort of what we could call, for the sake of shortness, intelligent performance, in the sense that this was opposed, and that he was very aware of this. He was opposing a kind of performance that was more about body, theater matrix, people naked on the cliché of happening that was representing for him, for instance, in the case of Lebel, which was a French artist. So he really very wanted to make a sort of intelligent performance, which I think for me was a mix of his exchange with Capro and his awareness of French theory. So he was at that time in the 60s, he was a big reader and translator of Merleau-Ponty and Levi-Strauss. And I think this is something that is super present in the happenings. And at that time already he had started to read Lacan. And I think there is also a big presence of this theory in the happenings, even if the happenings was a very small part of the life of Masota. And Lacan was a very big part of the life of Masota. And after after this, after 68, he completely devoted to Lacan. And so for him, it was, you know, a big lens to see the world and to understand. And he didn't do any clinic, but he considered that it was really his duty, almost like an apostle, to go and express the gospel of Lacan. And he really devoted his life to teach Lacan. And he did the whole, he went to see Lacan and all this stuff. But at the same time, there was also this paradox that I think is present in all the work of Masota, and that he refers when he in the book Introduction to Jacques Lacan, where he says all this that I teach is in the language of the Rio de la Plata, so that you have this kind of that you are Argentina. He's constantly referring to this. I do happenings, and I wish I could do happenings like in Sweden, and there comes the idea of the Swedish woman speaking, where he says, but alas, Buenos Aires is not a Swedish city. Or I teach Lacan and I study Lacan, but alas, I speak very bad French. It's spoken in the dialect of Rio de la Plata. And so he always is, and this, I think, a bit the relation of class as well, being very much aware that he doesn't belong to the class that he courts. Is that English again? Yeah. That he will never be accepted by this class. That he will always be someone who does not belong to university, someone who's poor, someone who's always living from hand to mouth. So all this kind of out of it is very present, the outsider character of Masota. And that's why he reflects the big mirror that he looks himself into is Roberto Arlt, that is the anti-Borges, the kind of author that was also perpetually an outsider. I don't know if they really fit, but of course, in a way, the teaching of Lacan was also one of the somehow was perceived as a hostile to the dictatorship, and so Lacanian psychoanalysis also had to escape. They also had to go. I guess any kind of thought is an enemy of the dictatorship. And so this was both the reason why he left, but also how he introduced himself to Spain, for instance, how he found an identity for himself as an exile, and also what connected him to the avant-garde in Spain, because he was escaping a dictatorship and he went to Spain at the end of a dictatorship. And somehow this acts as a bridge. And in this travel, he also went to Paris to meet Lacan with this wonderful anecdote that says he was very nervous before meeting Lacan, and he was meeting one of the friends, a friend that was an Argentinian psychoanalyst in Paris, and they say, ¿Y qué le digo? And then she say, dile bonjour. So it's like, yes, tell him bonjour. And but the fact is that they met and they liked each other, and Lacan has very warm words for Masota.
Any other questions?
Yes, hi. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but the happenings occurred in 66 and 67, mm-hmm. and the military dictatorship came to power in 73. Yeah. So there's like an interesting anachronism there. You seem to make a political statement through these reenactments. Even though Masota himself, when the dictatorship happened, decided not to go ahead with his festival.
But there was another dictatorship, because it had several.
Okay.
So there was Onganía dictatorship.
Okay.
At the time of the happenings.
Uh-huh.
But I also think that I ascribe a certain prophetic capacity to the happenings of what was to come. But at the time of the happenings, there was also a dictatorship. It was not as bloody as the one that came afterwards, but it was a dictatorship nevertheless.
Yeah, I really like the bit when they're in the library and the Argentinian guy is trying to explain this very convoluted history to the guy from Brussels. I mean, they have a very convoluted and very complicated history as well. But when he's trying to understand, how can you be anti-anti and then, you know, just wanting clarity, like, are they on the left or on the right? But that's not a way to understand anything. So I guess that is the, also the issue that there are like so many different.
But it happens to everybody. It's very difficult to understand Peronismo. And there are a few jokes about it. Like when Perón was exiled in Madrid and he was explaining Argentinian politics, I said, well, you know, you have these guys, and you have the left guys, and then you have the people that are Maoists, and then you have these other people, and it's like all these groups. And then they say, but who are the Peronists? I said, oh, Peronists is all of them. So that's a bit, everybody's a Peronist, but that doesn't mean anything. That's exactly what he says.
My question is, what is radical about a happening? Because at one point, there's a quote from Misato saying that he cancelled the happening because it seemed out of place, considering the gravity of what was going on. But then he says he changes his mind and now realizes that actually there was something radical in the, in the happening. And I just wonder if you could say, what's at stake in a happening? What's important?
Well, the happenings, they move in the realm of the symbolic, and they were formally radical. They are radical in the way they are realized, so in a, let's say, in a form sort of way. They are also radical in the kind of, I say, when I ascribe prophetic qualities, they are radical in the way the shadow they project into history and what is to come. And then finally, they are, the way he refers in the quote, actually he means more like the work of an artist is actually to be an artist and to produce what artists produce, which is art by nature. And then it's not the job of an artist to stop, because it will never be superficial, it will never be superfluous. Art is always necessary. And the job of an artist in situation of a political urgency is to do art. And so that's the quote that I think that's the big subject of the film, and that's why it's highlighted in the film.
Michael, did you have? Oh, I think that was a very
five minutes.
Oh, okay. Was there? Oh, yeah.
I think she was next. Yes, I think this film really intertwines so many currents, so many things that lead to this ambiguity of the past that is revisited, but at the same time is a performance, and this what you were mentioning, the reality of it, that is even more threatening than all the scenes are, even when they want to be reassuring from the beginning, when, you know, the director wants to assure everyone everything is fine, that these old people stand for an hour, and that, you know, that's fine, and you feel, you know? And so where all the trends come together and you don't know where to go, like with Perón. I mean, it was left, you know, there was a Che Guevara in this interrogation room, which you thought, well, maybe, you know, but of course Che Guevara was also extreme. Yes, just to, right. But it could be Che Guevara organizing it as well. You know, at that point, you really don't know the left. And that's it. So in this way, you are telling us now, you know, but of course, also the future, the prophecy. You know, there is a prophecy that all that is past is what we are living now, but at the level of a paranoia of things that chill you. You know, like, you know, of course, the last bit of the film is, I think, really a masterpiece. I must say, you know, I loved it. You know, these conversations, waiting for God knows what. What is all this for? But everyone is playing it, and you don't know who is the one who is interrogating you, why they are interrogating you, and whatever you say somehow is wrong. You know, so that the whole film gives gives that sense of, you know, of a revisitation which is not a revisitation but is an intertwining. Well, of course, then there is the spectator to be watched that requires a distance, but this distance is not really, you know, a distance, because the film takes all together who is watched, who is watching. Who is, so it's really, I thought it's a really very, very, very beautiful film. Thank you.
We seem to have 2 minutes. If someone has a last question, you.
Very quick one. Yeah, yeah. I'm just curious, where did you get all that people that you got in the library? They were all very, very varied people, and some of them very well informed. These guys could speak English, French, and so on. Where are they coming from?
They're all my friends.
They're very well informed. But I mean, maybe you could say something about that. Bringing, I mean, you mentioned that in the afternoon reading session as well, how it was really important to you that there were all these languages. And I mean, and there are not only all of these languages, but there are so many nationalities and locations. I mean, and you're not saying, oh, now you're in the Basque Country, now you're in Leuven, but, you know, in a way it flows between all those places. And in that library, I mean, it was like the first time I watched it, I was like, because I also could recognize some people. I mean, and you know, and then not others, and then I was confused, like, why are they there? But then, you know, maybe talk about that, like, yeah, languages and, like, transnationalism of the work. Because I think when you first watch it, you expect it all to be in Buenos in Argentina, and so then I thought, oh yes, look at that library. That's what like Borges was thinking of when he wrote. And then you're like, but it's full of Belgians. Why did she take all these Belgians to Buenos Aires? And then
Well, I was it has a bit of a connection of the film with the film of tomorrow, and then the whole thing started with Ricardo Piglia, and Ricardo Piglia gave me a story that he wrote that I think it was called the Finnegan's Islands, La Isla Finnegan, and in this island it was supposed that people speak all languages, but one after the other. So like the first 10 years they spoke one language, and then they slowly changed to another language, so that people who were just born they would not understand what the parents were speaking in, and so. This, from this, I really had the idea. It would be really nice to have this kind of scene in which you aimlessly go into from a language into another without really having this pain. Because well, the question of translation is very interesting in languages and how you have, for instance, Nazis that they speak English, and or dinosaurs who speak English. And I thought, well, in Brussels. In Brussels, you really have this is what happens in Brussels. This is how Brussels functions. So you have all these people speaking all these languages, and they start in Flemish, and they go into French, and they finish in English. And then I thought it would be nice to do it. And then, of course, with the wonder that a lot of friends are in Brussels, and then I could invite them, and they could discuss about all these things, metafiction and repetition. And then I just had to pepper a bit of Argentinians into it, but they were also friends. But I had to fly them over, not from Buenos Aires. One from came from Buenos Aires, but most of them lived in Paris, and so I just flew them in so they could drop the Argentinian part.
And that tied nicely with reminding you to come tomorrow to Finnegan's Way to the Joshin Society where Dora spent time with a group in Zurich that has been reading Finnegan's Wake for the last 30 years. Yeah. But the film is only like an hour. So thank you so much, and thanks.
Thank you. Dora.